Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we will continue with our series of ongoing roundtable conversations with the UBS Chief Investment Office Fixed Income Team. Joining us here on the line today, glad to welcome back both Barry McElinden and Frank Saleo, Senior Fixed Income Strategist for the Americas with UBS CIO. Leading today's conversation, glad to welcome back Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas, Leslie Falconio. So with that, Leslie, I'll pass it over to you to lead today's conversation. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Yes, a lot has happened since, you know, our last podcast, and, you know, a lot of good things, particularly for fixed income as an asset class and particularly for spread products as a whole. But first want to review some things with the Fed, which was yesterday. And, you know, obviously, as everyone knows, the Fed cut for the first time since 2020 yesterday, and as the saying goes, the first cut is the deepest, and they started off with 50 basis points, which, you know, we have to say, I mean, our economist, I do have to give kudos to, was really spot on in terms of, you know, his outlook on what the Fed path would be. And surprisingly, though, you know, when one thinks of a 50 basis point cut out of the gate, you know, we might anticipate a bit of yields declining, a little bit of jittery in the marketplace, given the fact that, you know, starting off with such a large magnitude could be a forward indication that maybe things aren't as solid as one might expect. But in essence, it was the opposite that occurred. And one of the reasons why that was is that, you know, Chair Powell was very well balanced in the sense that, yes, he went out of the gate with 50 basis points, but his commentary and his Q&A were, I would say, more neutral to hawkish. And what I mean by that is, you know, he obviously reiterated that, you know, inflation has been falling and the labor market, while cooling, is not crashing. So he, you know, he made the point that the economy is still very steady. They really want to be preemptive, so not to expect this magnitude of cut at every single meeting, but it was really more an insurance cut, if you will. And finally, when I look at this, when you think about the Fed is actually forward looking, you know, and try to head off the fact that if in fact the economy and particularly labor does start to cool, he kind of gave the market the signal, if needed, they can move. But he also reiterated that, you know, they can move quicker, slower, or even pause. And it depends on the economic developments, and it depends on, as Powell likes to use, the debt of dependence. Well, when we headed into this meeting, our call since, you know, really the third week of June has really been more for that bull steepener, meaning that yields will come down, and it will be led lower by the short end. Now, as fixed income always does, and particularly the fixed income market, the Treasury market got well ahead of itself in terms of the amount of, you know, Fed cuts that were anticipated by the market, particularly after the, you know, July rise in unemployment. So at one point in time, they had 250 basis points of cuts priced in. So given the fact that Powell sort of reiterated a dot plot, which includes, you know, 100 basis points for 24 another 50 basis points for 2024, 25 and 25 more, 100 basis points for 2025, and 50 in 2026, the fixed income market once again had to recalibrate a little bit to that Fed outlook. And I have to say, given the fact of how well risk assets have done, given how well the equity market has done, although yields are higher, they're actually quite, you know, I would say controlled. We've seen a large drop in volatility, and this has helped our most preferred assets, such as agency mortgage-backed securities, that have compressed, you know, to some of the tightest levels in 18 months, and have been a very strong outperformer because volatility has dropped. And remember, whether it's 50 or 25, you know, yesterday, the Fed is starting their cutting cycle. And because they're starting their cutting cycle, volatility should drop. Over the longer term, yields should move lower, and the curve should bull steepen. You're going to have periods of consolidation, like we're seeing right now, but this was actually more of a green light when it comes to fixed income and risk assets, and definitely a green light when it comes to investors starting to deploy that cash and locking in a bit, you know, longer interest rates, you know, not beyond that 5 or 6 year type duration, because again, we think that back end underperforms, but getting out of those money market or cash alternatives and start to lock in those yields. So with that said, I really want to turn first, and Barry, I'll go to you first in terms of the Fed and the Fed outlook. But I do want to ask, and if you could, just kind of give a recap of the performance of investment grade, what kind of potential you see from the Fed decision, and sort of your outlook as we go into the last quarter of the year.
Yeah, so investment grade is performing well on a total return basis. We're up 5.9%, you know, not surprisingly, kind of right in the middle of the road with other fixed income sectors. The price return is similar to what you're seeing in treasuries, so about mid 2%. But you are benefiting from the higher coupon that you're getting in investment grade. The market-weighted coupon is 4.4% versus 2.9% in treasuries. So the duration of treasuries, you know, has helped us tremendously. You know, looking out, we still think investment grade is positioned well for the remainder of the year, both on a fundamental basis as well as a technical basis. You know, there's no major industry sector that looks like they're re-leveraging their balance sheets, so it still looks strong from that perspective. And, you know, banks, even though spreads have normalized, we still think their credit profiles, you know, look sound in an environment where interest rates are declining, but that alleviates some pressure as it relates to their overall deposit levels. So we still expect, you know, strong profitability from the financials. They're a very strong component, a very large component within investment grade credit. So I think, you know, as their direction goes, you know, that's also an important driver for investment grade. I would note that our colleagues, you know, in CIO, just from the equity standpoint, are also looking for a fairly robust earnings outlook that's concurrent, you know, with the soft landing, you know, economic view. So in that environment, you know, we look for investment grade issuer fundamentals to, you know, be intact. You know, these aren't the highly levered companies that you see in the high yield bond market or the senior loan market. Senior loans, you know, have coupon levels that reset. So they've been pressured the most by high level of the Fed funds rate and short-term, you know, benchmark rates. The investment grade constituents are mostly locked in, you know, at fixed high levels of funding costs, albeit, you know, it has risen recently. So the investment grade constituents, you know, they're not going to be the primary beneficiaries of reduced cost of funding, you know, as the Fed lowers rates. You know, but again, their overall behavior as it relates to re-leveraging the balance sheets has been, you know, fairly benign. You know, part of this is the uncertainty about the economic outlook. I think that's kind of kept that restraint in place. So, you know, there could be a risk if we get a situation where the markets run a bit too hot. You know, we'll have to monitor the behavior of these corporate managers, you know, to make sure that they are still operating, you know, with a sound balance sheet, you know, type of mentality in mind. But, you know, but overall, don't really see, you know, again, any really large pockets of vulnerability within the investment grade sectors. Now, just turning to more of the supply demand backdrop, obviously on the supply side, we've had a very large volume of issuance this year, an investment grade, $1.2 trillion. And these past 3 months have been particularly strong, both in July and August, over $100 billion, which it kind of exceeded their normal expectations. In September, we've already met the volume size, about $130 billion. That's typical for September. And you know, part of this is just the fact that issuers are taking advantage of this window of opportunity, you know, kind of exists. Or, you know, before yesterday's Fed meeting, I think, you know, they wanted to get some issues out of the way. And also before the election, you know, in early November and potential volatility that comes around, you know, that event on the calendar. But again, in the context of, you know, the general healthy fundamentals, it's not like, again, companies are being reckless in raising this debt. A lot of it is being done to term out their overall, you know, maturity, the wall of maturities. And, you know, have those funds on their balance sheet for general use, you know, which can include debt pay down for maturities that come up within a shorter period of time. So the supply has been met with a quite robust demand because, you know, yields in investment grade, yes, they are down below 5% on average, but even at the high 4% level, you know, this is a level that, you know, we've kind of, we haven't seen, you know, it's, historically, it's, you know, it's still about the 60th percentile, like over the past 25 years. So, you know, it's still high from a historical perspective. And, you know, I think even the trajectory that we expect with the Fed beginning their rate cuts and where interest rates are going to be headed, you know, to the extent that the Treasury bond yields have already factored in multiple cuts. In fact, you know, most of the cuts that we expect for this hiking cycle are factored into treasuries already. So, you know, any further decline in treasury yields should be a little bit more limited in terms of their downward re-rating. I think what that means is that with credit spreads and IG already tight, any downward re-rating in investment grade yields should also be, nothing that's too dramatic, certainly nothing like we witnessed back in 2020, 2021. Remember, investment grade treasury yields were only in the 2% range on average. So even where we're headed, I think even if we do kind of eventually revert to more, let's say even a three handle investment grade yield environment, I still think that would present a kind of a seat at the table as far as yields go, and not back to that very low extreme type of environment that we witnessed right after the pandemic. So, yeah, again, overall, I think the investment grade asset class in our most preferred view is supported by both the fundamental and technical trends that we've been observing. I think the main risk for investment grade, really more macro, let's say hard landing, that eats away at company profits. And, that would be an environment where credit spreads probably widen out, but that's part of our thesis with investment grade bonds over their more credit sensitive high yield counterparts, is that investment grade, would not widen as much as you would see in the lower rated, high yield sectors. So with that, Leslie, I can turn it back to you.
Right. That's great, Barry. Thank you so much. And as our listeners know, we've had a most preferred, in IG with quite some time, and it's the resiliency of the sector, the performance of the sector has been, quite good. We continue with the most preferred, and as you'd mentioned, Barry, from a spread perspective, they might not be yet necessarily on the cheap side of the spectrum. But again, you get this high quality carry, which I think in an environment like this is very important to investors as well. I now want to go to Frank, and Frank, with the preferred side, there's no question preferreds have been an absolute knockout this year in terms of performance. And I'll be the first one to admit they've performed much better than I ever thought they would this year. They've really been, a surprise as to the outperformer, particularly thinking how we entered the year with, once again, the market was pricing in the recession, all of these cuts. And even as we saw the removal of this and all these cuts and interest rates rise in the first quarter, we still had sectors such as preferred and the, sort of lower, credit spectrum do, very well. So I want to ask you also in terms of, how the performance has been, what is the potential impact on the sector given, the Fed's move yesterday and what the Fed potential moves may be forward-looking, and how do you see this positioning over the last quarter of the year?
Yeah. Oh, great. You really made a great point there, Leslie, that performance from preferreds has really been a knockout for investors, and I mean that in a good way. Preferreds continue to perform very well, but recently they've just been on a tear, to your point. They've been on a tear. A lot of momentum, particularly since mid-August, when rates began falling very sharply. As you mentioned in your opening comments, there's been a lot of action in the Treasury market over the last several weeks. So since the mid-summertime, the 10-year Treasury yield dropped below 4% in early August, and it stayed there. It has stayed there. It remains below 4% now, and it stayed there for the longest stretch of time since May of last year. If we go back to the beginning of the summer, and in July, the 10-year Treasury yield was hovering around 4.20, 4.30. Let's call it 4.25 or so. And the 10-year yield closed at 3.62 as of Monday, so the lowest since June of last year. So a new 52-week low on the 10-year Treasury yield. And and definitely a lot of activity in the treasury market with rates coming down and accelerating to the downside, as you alluded to in your opening markets and your opening comments. And that's had a real tremendous impact on the preferred sector, really put the wind in the sails of preferreds. The sector had been doing pretty well and gaining steadily since April. April was a difficult month, when Treasury yields spiked after some hotter than expected CPI data. But since then, preferreds have been gaining about 1% per month in May, in June, in July, give or take 1%. So sort of slow and steady gains from the preferred space in May, June, and July. But again, as I mentioned, really accelerating with the drop in treasuries since mid-August. Preferreds gained close to 3% in the month of August alone. And so far in September, the preferred space is up 2.5%. So that means we're on track for a third quarter return of over 6%, roughly 6.5%. We still got about another week or so in the quarter, but really solid performance. I can break that up into two subsectors, 4.5% quarter to date for the $1,000 pars, and for the $25 pars, almost 9% quarterly gains so far in the third quarter. So the bottom line, things have really accelerated in recent weeks, and preferreds are on a tear. Now, the flip side of all that very strong and accelerated performance is that valuation has weakened. So if we look again at the path of treasury rates since the beginning of the year, we know that they did rise pretty significantly in the beginning of the year, especially in April, as I mentioned, after the stronger than expected CPI data. But since then, treasury rates have been gradually declining, and that decline accelerated in August. But still, even though the 10-year treasury yield has dipped below 4%, it hit a new 52-week low on Monday at about 362, as I mentioned. As we speak now, we're at about 375. But the point I'm trying to make here is that we're really not that far from where we were at the start of the year, maybe 25 basis points lower if we say the 10-year treasury yield was hovering around 4% at the start of the year. Preferred yields, on the other hand, have fallen by 100 basis points since the start of the year. So definitely lower treasury rates, lower levels on those risk-free benchmark treasury rates by about 25 basis points if we look at the start of the year. But in preferred land, those yields are down 100 basis points. We went from preferreds yielding around 6.5% to 7% in January down to 5.5% to 6% today. So the value proposition has weakened. A lot of this performance driving those accelerated returns has been rate optimism, as I've mentioned, but technical support has been a factor too. Those supply-demand dynamics that Barry was just mentioning with respect to the latest investment-grade corporate bond performance, we've seen a significant increase in preferred calls and preferred redemptions this year, and those redemptions have been supportive in that they create reinvestment demand, and that's likely been an additional support for preferreds this year as well. To put some numbers on it, we've had $33 billion worth of preferreds redeemed so far in 2024. That's pretty significant. The whole sector is only about, you know, let's call it $400 billion in size. So that's a pretty good, decent-sized turnover of preferreds being redeemed, about 30 to the tune of $33 billion so far this year. $37 billion have been issued. But interestingly, banks have primarily been redeeming more than they're issuing. So that's been a support in that the banks have been net redeemers of preferreds. Utilities, on the other hand, are making up the difference. So we've got net redemptions from banks, net issuance from utilities. Most of the new issuance has been in the $1,000 par space. And that's where we typically find preferreds with variable rate coupons, most notably or most typically or predominantly fixed rate resets. And frankly, this is where I think the yields yield opportunities can be found. Yields tend to be higher, certainly in the current state of the market. Yields are higher in the $1,000 par space than they are in the $25 par space. And in a $1,000 par space, not only are you getting higher yields, but you're getting these variable rate coupons, which make it a bit easier to mitigate risk volatility. So there are pockets of opportunity among preferreds, particularly in the $1,000 par space among these fixed rate resets, but selectivity is key. Some of the structures, particularly of the more newly issued fixed rate resets, are coming to market with particularly low reset spreads, and these require more surveillance. That's something that I wrote about in the latest update to the Preferred Securities Top Picks Monthly a few weeks ago. And finally, Leslie, in terms of outlook, I do expect some near-term choppiness, and we may even see a pullback before year-end. With year-to-date gains of, let's call it 10%, I think the sector has gotten a little bit ahead of itself. And again, valuation is quite tight, especially in the $25 par space. you know, valuations are probably getting a bit tighter in fixed income more broadly. The market, as you mentioned, is pricing in a lot of rate cuts. And I know Barry made this point as well. But bringing it back to preferreds, the valuation proposition is somewhat below historical averages. We do expect rates, treasury rates, to continue to trend lower. That would be supportive. But we've already had a big move in treasury rates, similar to the point Barry just made. So how much more remains to be seen? There will be a bias towards lower rates. Again, that's supportive for preferreds. But we just need the rate backdrop and the valuation proposition in the preferred space to stabilize and normalize. So, Leslie, that's where things stand right about now in preferred land.
That was great, Frank. Thank you. That was a really great summary. I appreciate that. And I think sort of as we sort of conclude now, I mean, we're at a situation now in the fixed income market where we do have a convergence of what the market is pricing in terms of cuts and what the Fed guidance gave. However, as we all are well aware, over these past 1 or 2, 3, 4 years, that even though we are definitely starting a cutting cycle, which should lead over the long term to lower rates, the more the Fed relies on that data dependence, you know, the more sort of push and pull you may see in the marketplace. So while we are constructive on fixed income overall, I mean, we are constructive on yields overall, we believe the shape of the curve will continue to steepen, and we think risk assets both for fixed income and equity, you know, will be fine given our soft landing outlook. There's no question that we're going to have these pockets of vulnerability, you know, going forward, but given our outlook is for a soft landing, we don't look at those pockets of vulnerability as a means to shed, but we look at those pockets as a mean to add in terms of, you know, longer term soft landing, the way to, you know, get good carry, to lock in, you know, greater yields. And while we have, you know, a year to date low this year in the 10-year yield of 3.59, and our outlook for June of 2025 is only a 3.5, you know, we'll be the first to admit that we're not looking for this huge tailwind of price appreciation, given the fact we don't believe the 10-year yield falls to 3% because we do have a soft landing outlook. You know, playing the market and be positioned and taking, you know, opportunity to invest in those pockets of vulnerability, I think will be a great strategy going forward. So thanks all very much, and we'll see you in 2 months. Thanks again.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investor investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.